Mics are live.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is Monday, May 13th, 2:40 p.m. This is a rulemaking discussion, a work session related to rulemaking. I'm Commissioner Brian Crotchis. For the record, with me today are Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk and Commissioner Randy Christman. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Christman?
I do not.
Commissioner Fedorchuk, and then staff, can you quickly identify yourself, starting with you, Pat?
Patrick Fahn, staff at Public Service Commission.
John Hsu, Public Service Commission staff.
Jerry Lynn, staff.
Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco, staff.
Okay, and then Jack, are you going to lead us through this, or?
I think Jack.
I'd be happy to.
I'm not quite sure who it falls under exactly. Probably you.
I think it, well, a lot of these seem to be siting related, but not everything. It's more of an attorney thing.
Right, and really this work session, I was just hoping to have a discussion with you to see what type of rulemaking you guys were looking at. I kind of had some off, between work session discussions with each and every one of you about possibilities of different rulemaking. And so just to kind of tee up the discussion, if you guys have any other thoughts, anything you'd be interested in exploring in addition to these, we could also discuss those as well. I did provide you all a list here so we could just run through these in order. And the first one I start off with is just the Siting Act. If you remember from the last rulemaking that we had, there was some discussion and we had some comments regarding the ICBM launch sites and launch control sites, and they had some thoughts on some language, and that was kind of beyond the scope of that current rulemaking, but I thought for the purposes of going forward, we could incorporate that into our next rulemaking if you're agreeable to that. And I think I actually put under a sub A there what they're hoping to, what they stated they would like to have under the energy conversion facilities, exclusion areas as well. The areas within 30 feet of either side of the direct line between intercontinental ballistic missile launch or launch control facilities to avoid microwave interference. That is the existing language under the transmission facilities, but it currently is not under the energy conversion facilities. And so they wanted it to be for both. I think.
Would that be 30 feet, tip of turbine, tip of turbine?
I believe so.
Not turbine, I'm sorry, blade.
The base, the tip?
No.
Well, does the pedestal cause the interference, or is it the rotating blade, and is that the corridor?
I don't know if I could speak to that, but we actually have a couple of members here who would like to actually provide some comments, I believe, if you guys would be open to it.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Why not?
And then if you could identify yourself for the record, that'd be terrific. Thanks.
Push the button. Yeah.
This is Lauren Kinker. I'm the community planner for Minot Air Force Base. To answer your question, the 30 feet we would like measured to the tip of the blade, the horizontal tip of the blade. And that is a clarification that we would like to see added to the rules for the exclusion zone as well, the 1,200-foot exclusion area, if possible.
And how does that affect existing facilities? I mean, are all of them sited to meet that currently? Do you know?
We've been able to work with the majority of wind farm developments to get this
okay
to happen. So just getting in the rules will help us in the future.
Mm-hmm. Knowing ahead of time that.
Lars, were you saying the 1,200 feet in addition to that? 30 feet is what you're saying, or because I heard 1,200 feet, and I'm not sure if I understood.
Oh, the clarification that the measurement should be to the tip of the blade rather than the base. Can we have that apply to all of the different measurements that are in the document?
So from the tip of the blade to where?
So for instance, the 30 foot you would measure from the middle of the line out 30 feet to the tip of the blade that extends horizontally rather than the base of the pillar.
Right, right.
So upward.
Okay. Yeah, because your blade's going to be much higher.
Yes, sir. Yes.
In your facility.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren, before this work session, you discussed the 1,200-foot setback. you were just saying from all, you're looking at possibly expanding that?
Yes, that's a separate issue. The 1,200-foot setback that we currently have right now from the center of our facilities out is great, but for our helicopter forces, that limits their tactical abilities, having them that close. Essentially, the further out, the better for our helicopter infill and exfill exercises, and should something happen, of course, that's going to limit their maneuverability. So we would like to request that you consider expanding that radius. That's something that we're working on, figuring out what exactly it is that we need. Basically, they've said the more the better, so looking at what a reasonable ask would be for that. But just wanted to bring it forward to see if it's something you would consider.
I would, but I'd need to know the rationale.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
The more the better won't work for the industry. So
exactly, yes.
So if it's 1,500 feet and that's based on, you know, the needs of your typical helicopter or whatever, then I think there's justification for it. But
yeah, so that's something we're working on, is getting what that exact measurement is, because there's different parties that need to weigh in on this.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So if I remember this before, there was some buried cables or something that were in that distance in there, and they didn't want those cables messed up.
Yes, sir. We do have cables that extend from the various facilities to each other, and we've been able to identify any encroachment with those with the North Dakota One Call system. The 1,200-foot is the actual area that the Air Force holds an easement for.
Okay.
With the landowners. So that's probably where that number came from originally.
Okay.
And commissioners, I could continue to be in communication with them and bring back something as a proposal for a later work session, if you guys are comfortable with that.
Well, I think we should explore it, but I just want to reemphasize the more the better isn't going to work.
Exactly,
You're going to probably need to settle on an amount and then show some evidence that less than that amount causes exactly what problems.
Yes, definitely.
And that by setting this amount will allow whatever things it is.
Yeah. Well,
and you said you have worked with them in the past. So does that mean that there would be no existing encroachments of that 30-foot deal, or are there a couple out there that...
I don't know on the 30-foot encroachment exactly. We've been working with the Russo Wind Farm, and they were able to move one of their turbine locations to be out of that line-of-sight corridor. That's the one I'm aware of at this time. I don't know of the other existing wind farms, how much encroachment problems there are at this point.
I don't know if this is relative, but how... From the line of sight, can that be a mile? Can it be 2 miles? 5 miles if it's...
As far as between the facilities, what are we looking at for microwave?
Is it 30 feet from the tip of the blade, you know, up to a distance of 1 mile or indefinitely or whatever line of sight is present?
The way they're laid out is you have the missile alert facility, the control facility in the center, and then the launch facilities are surrounding it. So it's from that central point to each individual.
And that's all area. Line of sight?
That is the line of sight that we're looking to protect.
How far from, what's the maximum distance? Or just ballpark. And forgive me, I'm just,
oh, no.
This isn't in my wheelhouse. Okay, so we're talking a 30-foot corridor that could extend 5 miles.
Actually, a
60-foot
corridor, yes.
Or 60. Yeah. And then just you had mentioned as you worked through, and I think you heard from the other two in terms of, you know, just looking for, and you used the word reasonable, I think, when you were explaining at the onset. So that would be perfect.
Yes, we'll work on getting that number to you in our background. For that.
Cool. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Anything
much.
Else you would?
No, sir.
Or maybe Jack, maybe you're supposed to ask her that.
No,
I have one question. What we got here says areas within 30 feet of either side of a direct line between intercontinental ballistic missile launch or launch control. Should that, is that a line from the launch facility, the launch control facility, to the pad, to the missile pad?
Yes, this is the language that is in the other section of your existing rules, so I believe that's where the verbiage came from.
Okay. So. So it would be more accurate to say and instead of or there.
Yeah, that would probably clarify that.
And Jack, you'll continue to coordinate with?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Lauren, just so you understand our process on these rules.
Yeah.
It'll cost us money to advertise them, so we like to kind of bundle them up a little bit, and then the committee that has the last look at them meets quarterly. So when we bundle some up, then that's, it's not like a week or two later we want to do it again. So I don't know when we'll get the next set of hearings going, but whenever it is, you want to be ready for it.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Keep that in mind when you coordinate with Jack.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the second discussion piece would be the solar decommissioning. And
so, Jack, are we going to add the siting, the other siting? Oh, never mind. I see it here. Okay.
The second item that I had on the list was the solar decommissioning, and I've already started to draft it up, and in a lot of ways it's currently mirroring the wind decommissioning rules. That being said, it doesn't have to mirror it at all. It can become something completely different as well. Just a couple things I thought I'd bring for discussion to see what your interest would be as I draft them is the definition of the solar energy conversion facility. If you remember in the wind decommissioning, we really base the decommissioning requirements upon who has the site certificate. And so it's really tied to having a site certificate. And however, we do have the authority to have requirements for wind facilities that are commercial beyond wind farms that have a site certificate as well. And I was wondering if that would be how you would like to apply it for the solar farms as well. I think the megawatt threshold level is 50 megawatts right now, so a 20 megawatt solar facility came in and we wrote it similar to the wind rules, that wouldn't be covered. I think I discussed with a couple of you at various points in time if you would like a different megawatt level, which we could write the rules to accommodate that as well. I think I heard 10 megawatts one time as well as maybe 20.
What? How big a facility is jurisdictional for a siting certificate?
50 now.
50?
50 megawatts.
Okay.
For which?
For any energy conversion facility aside from wind. I have had some preliminary discussions with Cass Electric, and they don't have anything even at 10 megawatts right now. So I'm not sure. Is there any thoughts on a threshold level? Or
I feel like this conversation should take place after we talk about
the
wind farms that were built before
the
siting on here. Because I think that is the first question we need to find out, whether we want to impose the decommissioning requirements on them or not.
Sure. If we like, we can hop down to those and come back up.
If we do, then I don't know why we would exclude a 40 megawatt solar farm at this point.
Sure.
I think we should be consistent, and I think the most obvious case of them has to do with the wind farms that are already there as opposed to a speculative or possible solar farm.
Okay. Maybe just for the purpose of discussion, we can hop down and talk about the wind decommissioning. And come back up to this.
So we wouldn't So basically, the decision is whether or not we impose decommissioning requirements on non-jurisdictional facilities from a siting standpoint.
I'd just like to clarify that they would be jurisdictional to us. We have the authority, in my reading, to require them.
To decommission?
Yes.
Even though the threshold's 50?
The siting threshold is. This isn't under the Siting Act. This is under the powers of the commission.
Mm.
Yeah. Non-jurisdictional for siting, jurisdictional for decommissioning.
Right.
You're kind of both saying the same thing differently.
Right back.
That's fair.
For the decommissioning, we determine what's jurisdictional.
That's correct.
Because it's left vague in the law.
Right.
No, I understand that. I'm just processing in my head, I guess, the fact that they're not one and the same, obviously. Even though they get tied in...
Should we hop down to the wind decommissioning real quick?
Sure.
I think that's a better order to take on.
And so, as you are all aware, we do have the wind decommissioning rules out there, and currently they are tied to whoever has a site certificate, the owner is. And that being said, there are facilities out there without site certificates, which we would have the authority, if we chose to, require them to have decommissioning financial assurances as well as decommissioning plans. And I'm not sure if Jerry could speak a little more to that. I do know there are a few out there. I probably would estimate off the cuff probably 330 to 340 megawatts of wind out there. One wind facility that I did find would be up to 91 megawatts with no requirement for decommissioning plans or financial assurances. And whether the commission would like to have the rules remain that way, or whether you guys would like to ensure that we could require them to do that by putting that in our rules.
My understanding is that this is an attorney general's opinion, or is it a court case or something that clarified that we would have the authority to require it?
That's correct.
What was the context of that? Who asked for that clarification? We've never required it yet, so...
We requested it. And if you look at the previous rulemaking that we did before this most recent one, it was open-ended, and we could require it for those facilities as well. When we were promulgating those most recent rules, I wasn't aware of all the siting thresholds, as no one in staff recognized either before we sent it out. And so there is that gap for those times where it popped up to 100 megawatts and then down to 60 before it dropped to half a megawatt, where there were certain facilities out there that did not require a site certificate. And so with that in mind, they're technically not really subject to the rules as they're written right now. Our rules just kind of have... They only address the ones with a site certificate.
Well, I'm kind of torn on this. I'm not a fan of going out and trying to do a decommissioning plan on, you know, old fraction of a megawatt turbines here and there. Until you told me about the Attorney General's opinion, I thought it was just something that was going to be what it was going to be, just like old coal mines. Some of them didn't get reclaimed because they were mined before the SMACRA law went into effect, or before North Dakota reclamation laws. And so I'd have been fine with that too, but at this point we need to get some consistency. And bottom line is, I don't have real strong feelings on this. I think one option is to set a mark, and whether that's 50 or 20 or 10, I certainly don't think it should be one. Unless we did it one just based on that's what the siting requirement is for the wind, I guess that would be a reason for it. The other option would be to leave it as it is and not do this and notify the legislators where these facilities are and say, you know, you haven't been clear, so just let us be clear to you that we're your facilities in your districts aren't subject to this rule.
What if we did it where the facility could apply to not be subject to the decommissioning?
I'm sorry, could you?
Where a facility could make a case for not having to do it. Yeah. Kind of like we do for the site certificate, sort of. Or they can opt out, or we can give them exemption or something, some of them.
We already somewhat have a process for that because we have the 5-megawatt waiver from certain provisions of our
right. Goals. Yeah.
So the small ones, those 1 or 2 megawatt turbines, we wouldn't, as long as they requested. And for example, Lake Region State College, that was the one.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Recently saw. They had a couple small facilities. I think actually one turbine that they required a site certificate for because they hit that 0.5 megawatt level, and so we didn't require them to have a decommissioning plan or financial assurances. And I believe also the annual certificate of continuing operation, we didn't require them to do that as well.
And then it would at least trigger a conversation with us, because quite honestly, even if it's just one massive turbine, do we really want to just sitting out there indefinitely? I mean, it would be nice to have a conversation at least with whoever owns it to say, what are your plans? And if they have some reasonable plan, then we probably don't need to go through the whole formal process. But these are huge, huge, huge industrial pieces of equipment sitting out there that we don't necessarily want lingering around for 100 years. Who's going to take them down? New landowner?
You sign the leases.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I like the idea of going forward and requiring decommissioning but offering an exemption, and they can request an exemption. Okay. Quite honestly, I think that's what the public expects, because when we're asked, do we have decommissioning, we say yes, we do now. But there's this whole category of facilities that don't. The ones that were permitted before they, you know, permitted under the threshold and don't have a certificate.
No, I would agree. It's far from taken care of.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the honest answer.
I think we probably could write something to that degree, but with that in mind, we would essentially be expanding our, I mean, we would be saying that we may require them to have a decommissioning plan or financial assurances mm-hmm. in place, or be subject to the rest mm-hmm. of these, however they allow the opening for them right. to make a case why they wouldn't need to then.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. Yeah. But, I mean, some of these are 60 megawatts or, I mean, 81 megawatts. I mean, that's a big facility. It's a lot of turbines.
If you look at the rule here, it defines the owner as the one who holds a site certificate. Other than that, it's 500 kW for the size. So if you just change that, I think it's good.
What are you looking at, Jerry? I guess I don't have that in front of me.
9.
The rule itself.
Yeah.
And what does it say? Maybe you should read it.
Owner means a person who holds a certificate of site compatibility pursuant to North Dakota Century Code 4922. And there was a period of time when the siting threshold size was bouncing around. The next era kept on changing it so that they wouldn't have to cite their stuff, you know, and getting the legislature to change it. And at one point, I think it was 99 megawatts. Anything below 99?
Below 100.
Below 100, that's what it was.
Yeah.
So the 99 facility would not get cited. And then that dropped down to the 50.
And it was 60 at one.
60 at some point.
60, yeah. And now I think it is the 500 kW level.
That's correct.
So anything that's a commercial facility, which is 500 kW mm-hmm. or more. So we would not have to do the stuff that Randy was talking about for the farmer's little water mill or something that he's got out there.
So if we set it at a half of megawatt, then...
Yep.
We've set it
under the current rules, can we do an exemption?
If we set it at half a megawatt, they all would be required to it. There wouldn't be a... You can make a showing why they shouldn't be. It would be the exact opposite. They would have to have decommissioning plans and financial assurances unless the exemption provides for them, which right now is set at 5 megawatts.
Yeah. So I think the community college up there asked for an exemption.
That's correct.
To it.
Sure. Well, what you are saying is a little bit different than what they're saying as well. We can do that either way.
Yeah.
But,
does it accomplish the same thing?
I think it could.
We'd have to look at it. That's just off the top of my head. But it seemed like you could just eliminate that owner as being the certificate holder.
Well, we could change it any number of ways.
Yeah.
We could say everyone has to.
Yep.
However, we could change that exemption amount to anyone below, for example, 20 megawatts can request that they don't have to have a decommission plan of financial assurance in place. So, I mean, there's room to move in that.
I would say, yeah, you guys think about how to draft it and then come back with a proposal.
Sure.
It seems like we're kind of all on the same page.
We're talking about a proposal that will, barring them getting an exemption, require a decommissioning plan of financial assurances for anything over a half a megawatt. Is that what I'm
That would be correct.
Okay. And that's on the wind. Was there anything else on the wind that...
For the decommission, when decommissioning, that's all.
Okay. So then, I guess the next question is, do we set the same threshold for solar, even though we don't cite them, if they're under 50? And since we're doing the wind now that didn't get cited, I don't know why we wouldn't do a 40 megawatt solar farm.
Right. Is there a definition for commercial grades? Because solar is so different that, I mean, I have neighbors in
commercial is
down the street.
Commercial is 500 kW of the Siting Act for the energy conversion facility for the purpose of siting. There is no definition under the powers portion saying what you would make it as a determination mm-hmm. of what is a commercial wind
yeah.
farm. So it doesn't have to be. It's nice when they all line up because it makes our life just a little bit easy for understanding, but it doesn't have to be that.
So the people that live down the street from me that kind of got grandfathered into the city and they have a big lot, like a couple acre lot, they have several rows of solar panels in their yard. It doesn't seem reasonable that they should have to come up with a decommissioning plan and financial assurances to us. So how do we exempt? I mean, solar is a little different because you can actually use it as an individual pretty easily.
Well, it's not.
I think one thing I'd point out is 500 kilowatts is quite a bit of solar. That's a pretty
big
area. 10 megawatts.
So we'd automatically be getting.
Well, 10 megawatts would take approximately 35 to 40 acres of land.
Wow.
Just to keep that in perspective.
Did you say 5 megawatts or 5 watts? 500.
500 kilowatts.
500 kW is half a megawatt.
I know, but so, how big of a solar array is that? A lot?
If you were a private person putting up one, you would want, I don't know, 10 kW maybe. Something like that just to power your house.
No, we just exempt residential.
So 500 kW would be a lot bigger than you would need.
Non-commercial use, although we have to look down the road when we get into aggregated, because that non-commercial residential customer, if they become part of an aggregated network. Here. Oh, go ahead, Alana, sir.
No, go ahead, Jer.
Okay. Here it says in definitions, this is in the decommissioning rules, commercial wind energy conversion facility means a wind energy conversion facility with one or more wind turbines that has a total nameplate generating capacity equal to or greater than 500 kW.
Right, but what we'd be doing is changing that definition is what we're talking about.
Okay.
So if we call it commercial, that excludes...
That is commercial because we've defined that as commercial.
But that excludes residential, right?
But what I was going to say is I don't think you want to totally ignore in your definition the concept of being commercial versus residential. I mean, the legislature wouldn't have used the word commercial if it just wanted a size definition.
Right.
You know, so you may incorporate something like that and then take care of all your residential home use things.
Right.
Somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, I would, and Graham, this is, I think I came up with, I was just kind of looking in general how much solar you would have to have, and you'd have to have a lot of acres to have 10 megawatts in the first place. And I just took that, I think, based on the Harmony Solar application. Take that.
Well, we talked about it. I think I gave you some numbers on it in terms of proportionally. So I'm thinking 10 megs or maybe less.
And what's wrong with 500 megawatts? Too small? Kilowatts? Because it's just consistent then.
Yeah.
Well, did you mean 10 megs or 10 kilowatts?
Megs.
Megawatts.
That's a lot. I mean, that's a pretty substantial size.
Well, I thought we were working at 50, and I'm thinking 50 is way too much.
It should be
500 kilowatts.
Residential versus, you know, and then commercial and to exclude the people who are just using it for home use and stuff.
I'm okay with 500 kW.
And then put a 500 kW on it to keep it consistent.
I can move
it. The consistency part with the wind, I think, is helpful that they would both be the same. Mm-hmm. Just a perspective thing. Harmony is 200 megawatts and 1,600 acres, so about 8 acres per megawatt. I don't know if that makes a decent comparison or not, but so then 500 kVs, they would be using about four acres for every 500 kVs.
Well, not necessarily completely true, because Harmony occupies 1,300 acres with panels out of the 1,600. So when you get into a smaller facility, they're not going to have long access roads and whatnot.
Roads and stuff,
I mean, they'll have a little inlet, but...
If you guys are fine with it, I'll probably start with the half a megawatt, and from there we'll have the opportunity to solicit feedback and have a robust discussion about what's an appropriate level. I'm sure
someone will tell us if that's an inappropriate number.
Yeah.
Cumbersome.
I think we'll probably get some consternation from... Well... We can open it up.
We can just continue. There are a couple other things I just want to bring up with regards to solar decommissioning. The construction financial assurance. If you recall, we have for the construction phase of building a wind farm, we require financial assurances. And I was curious to see if you guys would want that as well for the solar facilities as well. I know there was some concern when we did the wind that they would be rushing to get the production tax credits, and that was kind of the reason why we had that, so they wouldn't go up and dig a bunch of roads and do things such as that and then just kind of leave it be, just to fall within that safe harbor of the production tax credits, which they don't have production tax credits for solar power. And it'd be one less thing probably for staff to have to look at as well for solar facilities.
Is there a similar rush on the solar, though, to get their other tax credits that they receive? Or I'm just trying to remember the conversation that we had on the one we cited, what level of urgency there was that might cause some company to start something and then stumble.
I guess I couldn't speak to that. I haven't witnessed any. At least on a nationwide reading of what's going on in the utility world, there being a rush to capture anything for solar, for tax credits. But that being said,
It's a little different. It's an investment tax credit. It's not production tax credit. So maybe that works. that changes things, maybe.
I believe it does.
You know, if it's included in the rules package, we could eliminate it. Mm-hmm. If it's not included, I suppose we can't really add it without going through a whole new rule process, right? Because no one would have known to come and testify against having it in there.
Well, if you recall, with our wind rules, we actually did add the construction phase into it because we initially required construction financial assurance prior to construction. Mm-hmm. Then, after soliciting comments, there was concerns about that and being able to get all that in place during all those different phases, that they wanted just a set construction financial assurance in place, just so they knew that they could get started in construction and then provide one once they actually know and could properly estimate the decommissioning costs once they started constructing it and had their whole plan in place.
So wouldn't we have the same concern with solar projects where, you know, if we require assurance up front, they might want the same kind of thing? Like a construction?
They may want that, and they may not want that at all. They may say that's not necessary. That's what I was just trying to point out, that it may not actually be necessary for solar to have that construction phase at all, depending on what concerns you have.
I mean, there aren't roads. There aren't... Really? Not many roads, right?
Well, there are.
There'd be a road to the Palace Road.
Yeah. Is there roads through the whole thing?
Probably not.
Every row is a road.
You have to access each panel. I think you have backside road. I don't know how deep the panels are, though.
Do they actually build roads out there? Or do they just drive through the
I think it was an aggregate road.
Really?
As I recall, but...
Packed gravel, I think.
It's got to be aggregate. They're not going to get around out there a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's true.
In that county.
You have to plow it, though.
What do you do with the snow?
I would like to see us put it in at first and then get comments on it at the rule.
I think if we're going to be consistent, though, from a megawatt or a half meg standpoint or threshold standpoint, I'd like to be consistent with how we handle any type of decommissioning.
There certainly isn't any more work for me to just write it with construction phase as well. Okay. I think that at least for the solar decommissioning, those are the questions I have right now.
I have another one.
Sure.
And you have it on here, too. I'm not convinced that we should be leaving these pilings in there. I'm not even convinced we should have one time long ago went down the track of leaving the concrete footings in on wind turbines. You know, it always is portrayed as this impossible thing. You got this big, 60-foot diameter concrete chunk under there, and how are you going to chip that away? Well, dynamite is how you remove rocks like that, and it's not that big of a deal. But that's gone, and now I'm arguing against consistency, I guess, but these solar farms are different. It's not just a handful of smattered big foundations that are left out there, oftentimes out on hills and things like that. This is pilings that covered a pretty significant percentage of that property. I think there were multiple panels on each piling, but not that many. There's lots of pilings. And that really wasn't the point of the hearing, since decommissioning rules aren't in effect. Mm-hmm. But I would have liked to have learned more about what's so hard about pulling these pilings back out and cleaning it up. And if there's a good reason to cut them off and abandon all them in place, then they could make that. But it seems to me that I just have never been convinced that that should be so difficult in this day and age to just pull those out and clean it up.
So you would like... Sorry.
I'm sorry. You would think a wind farm would have a lot bigger foundation than a solar pedestal.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you could just yank that solar pedestal out.
No, I don't.
Wind farm thing is pretty hard to get out of there.
Well, you'd blast it if you wanted to, but that's water under the bridge. We've decided to leave those. I don't know that that makes a good case for leaving these pilings. It's two different things in my mind.
Yeah.
So for the initial rules, you'd be interested in having the metal anchors for the panels to be entirely removed as part of them.
That's my thought here, and whether they're metal, or I don't know if they can
dig.
I don't know if they can bore holes and pour concrete, or and there wasn't cement on that one.
There isn't any cement.
But could a different company, instead of pushing in a steel piling, drill a hole and fill it with concrete? I don't know, but whatever it is, it's. It seems to me these pilings could be removed. And if not, I would like to see have them come in and explain why that's unreasonable.
Okay. Well, from a practical standpoint, though, I believe they're incredibly difficult to remove because a company is not going to be overly excited about having to go to each individual piling on a solar farm, digging down at least 4 feet, probably a few feet below that, to be able to get down deep enough to cut them, unless they're putting a larger piece and telescoping in a smaller piece in which it would slide out. But I'm just thinking that's a lot of work to get down 4 feet, and if it were easier to pull them, I think they'd be pulling. But yeah, maybe we just need to know more. Not even maybe, I think we need to know more before I could say, yeah, let's have them pull them, or let's...
Sometimes
or if it could be pulled.
Companies will make an argument that removing it is doing more damage than leaving it in there.
How else do you cut it down 4 feet below the surface?
Yeah.
Below grade, you've got to dig it out, right? And then torch it?
That was the argument.
Cut it with a torch?
Cables.
What?
We let them keep the cables at 4 feet down.
But this, we're not avoiding the disruption. They're digging all
the way
out.
Yeah, we don't know, so let's propose it and then get comments on it.
That's apparent we don't know. You're picking up on that?
Yeah. Spend 10 more minutes talking about something none of us know.
Darn it, I'm firm on it. So
The next two items I added to the list, and this was just from discussions with Pat and Jerry of possible rulemaking or stuff they were interested in. And I think Jerry mentioned something about removing or lowering the decibel level
as an
avoidance area for wind?
Yeah, I would propose it at 45 instead of 50.
Mm-hmm.
I just, from listening to people like Hessler and stuff, 45 seems to be what a lot of people are going with.
Okay.
And between 45 and 50, that's a pretty good amount of noise.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think that makes, I mean, we have that testimony from two cases now from the sort of third party sound person.
Yeah.
And he makes a case for 45, doesn't he?
And
that I thought it was.
He made a case for 45.
And you know, we've gotten noise complaints.
Right.
So
Jerry, I think you were talking about the 100 feet from the house, and you said that had no real appreciable difference on the sound.
That's what somebody said to me in the stand in one of those hearings, that it really didn't make any difference if there's a 100 feet difference. The sound didn't attenuate very much over a 100 foot level.
Mm. Yeah.
And I don't know, I'd be fine with leaving the 100 feet in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that you measure it a little bit further away from their house than right on their house.
So Jerry kind of brought that up for discussion a while back, and I just thought I'd float it to the commission to see if that would be something you would like to see.
I would. You guys up for it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
45 with a continuing waiver provision that allows a...
Sure. Yeah, people can waive it if they want.
But this would be subject to... This is for new ones. This isn't a burden on existing.
Right. Yeah.
And we'll see what companies have to say about it.
Sure. The next one would be pipeline safety. Pat had a small rule change that you would like to put in.
We have to do that periodically. We have to adopt the latest rulemaking that PHMSA has adopted, so we stay the same. So that's a catch-up.
I'm in favor of that.
And the next one is the possible siting procedure. If you all recall, House Bill 1383 requires agency comments to be in 30 days to be considered, 30 days prior to the hearing. And I know some of you express some thoughts that maybe we need to do something differently due to that change, maybe adding a couple things to the application to ensure that the agencies have all the information they need, as well as maybe setting out some time frames.
I think it's pretty important to establish time frames for company filings. If the agencies have to get their filings in 30 days ahead of time, then the company has to have final project information in a certain amount of time in advance of that. And so I think we should establish that in the rules so that it's clear.
Okay.
And that everybody kind of knows what the expectations are, and we don't spend a bunch of time at hearings going, well, we didn't get it in time, we couldn't comment, and blah, you know, there's all that waste. It's just a waste.
I know Commissioner Chrisman, just to piggyback on that, you had some thoughts about whether they should be moved, or because if they provide comments, they receive all the 60 days prior, then after 30-day cutoff, they can't provide any more information. And after they receive the information, if the facility changes substantially, the application or amendment, whether the information they provided would even be useful at that point in time. I know you have some thoughts and concerns about that, Commissioner Chrisman, right?
Well, I'm not sure if I had anything that hasn't been close to being addressed here, though, but I don't know what the time frame is ahead of this 30 days, but I've had frustrations growing. It seems like the problem is getting more significant, mm-hmm. of these plans changing so dramatically right before we're having hearings. And clearly now, because the law didn't get changed, it still is that we take into consideration information from these agencies. They have to have their comments in 30 days before. And so you can't logically conclude that it's okay to put out an application that says X, let them comment 30 days before, and then just change the application to Y so that they're ignored. So clearly, we're going to have to finalize these site plans some days in advance. And I'm not saying that finding a grave out there or something and one thing shifts over 50 feet or something like that is so dramatic. But if it is significant changes in the site plan, I think we are just going to have to start over and cancel the hearing and give those agencies time to respond.
The reason
and
why...
By the way, I'll add, it goes beyond that, because there's also the public. That's the point of the hearings, is the public testimony. And when all these things are changing at the last minute, how are they supposed to respond, too?
My initial thought was not to set deadline times and try to address this just administratively. And then as we went forward, we'd probably be able to see exactly how we need this to operate and then promulgate rules after that. But I was thinking on the front end, it would be useful to know what these agencies need and require them to provide that in the application prior to being deemed complete. So if they had that information, they should be able to get the information to us well ahead of the time period. And we could also, of course, solicit discussion with them as well to see whether how much time they need to actually review and provide feedback on that.
I don't really like the idea of playing around with it for 2, 3, 4 hearings before we decide, because meanwhile, you know, you've had a clumsy process or somebody doesn't get, I don't know, I just think there's just too much focus on these issues right now to open it up for further gray area. I think that the legislature clarified it in terms of they don't want last-minute comments from the agencies. So there's this 30-day rule. So then for us to make sure that we're getting good input from these agencies, I want to know that they've gotten what they need to make right. provide their good input. And so they need to have their information a set time. The company needs to have their information out a certain amount of time before that 30 days. I don't know what that time frame is, but that's, I think that's not something we need to play around with for a year. I think we should establish that on the front end and be done with it.
Game and Fish commented on that, you know, in relation to that workshop we had recently. And they said that they need to have the stuff. And they were expecting this 30-day thing from the legislature. They were expecting that. And so they said they needed to have the information 30 days before that.
Yeah.
And that's in their comments.
Okay.
So they've given us an idea.
Say 30 days at a minimum.
So 30 days before the 30 days that they have, you know, that deadline.
30 days before their deadline.
Sure. But they need all the information then.
Yeah. And I think it would be also helpful, maybe this isn't in the rules, but for there to be more clarity on what the information is that they need. And it isn't just Game and Fish. This is all agencies.
Right.
So this applies to SHPO. Mm-hmm. So can they still provide their letters a week ahead of time? SHPO. I mean, this is.
Yeah, SHPO gets behind sometimes.
Yeah, and the company comes in with the letters that, you know, the week of the hearing or mm-hmm. the day of the hearing.
Or it's not even, we had the hearing and the.
Or we have the hearing and then the letter's not done.
What did 1383, was it say? Is it all agencies or is it?
All agencies.
Well, I could reach out to the agencies and see if they have some feedback on that for initial promulgation. They could comment afterwards.
Yeah.
I sure hope we don't have to go longer than 30. That's just, we get to be kind of a burden on the siting process, too. I hope these don't end up dragging out like the coal people have to go through.
So just to, I guess, try to summarize what I'd be looking at putting together, possible additions to the siting process or to the application process to make sure that some of the companies have the information that they need, a time period that the companies or that the agencies would need in order to review these this information to give us some feedback. And I think that's probably that.
So, Jay, basically, we need to establish a deadline for when the companies have their final studies and information.
In a final study, right.
What did you mention? Asking the agencies what they need to make
On the application.
Yeah.
The another thing to point out, though, too, is this is only for the electrical siting side, not the pipeline. And the refinement plants, and so I'm not sure we'd want to probably write this specifically for that, then,
right?
And leave the other side out.
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. All right, and I think the other two, I'm just going to. Sorry, go ahead.
The Dakota Skipper things, wetlands too, for pipeline as well.
Yeah, but that's not the 30 days. Isn't applied to those guys, to those projects. Are you thinking for a different rule, Pat?
No, I was thinking of for U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Game and Fish.
Can you reference, kind of start at the beginning, just in the event someone...
Oh. The you were talking about doing this for just the electric side, and I was wondering about, and not doing it for the pipeline side, and I was wondering about the pipeline side, because an example is the One Oak case that we just had. They had done extensive study on the Dakota Skipper so they could respond to U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Game and Fish. But
this is establishing a deadline for the company to get their information in. That's what we're doing with this.
Right.
I don't think we need to do that for pipelines because there isn't the 30-day requirement that agencies respond.
Okay. So I'm not inclined to go down that road.
Okay.
Just a couple different housekeeping things. I just thought I'd let you be aware, not that we need to have a broad discussion about this. Staff will probably be proposing to change up some trade secret stuff. We get some manual filings for telecom that we have granted protection for on a consistent basis, but we didn't capture them the last rulemaking we did to give them automatic protection. And I think I was talking with Victor this morning and actually Alana as well about some of the annual filings under public utilities as well, to just kind of cut down the active commission orders on a lot of those trade secrets items. Good. But we'll be gathering a couple different things that we'd be looking at.
Good.
Okay. And the other thing is,
if we made those automatic, there'd still be enough work for legal to keep everybody occupied.
Believe it or not, I only have 5 left. I've caught up all the hundreds since I started here to 2000.
Yeah, but how many hours have you spent on it?
Just a couple.
Yeah, I'm in favor of proceeding with it.
Paperwork Reduction Act.
Right. Alana discussed something with me this morning about changing one of our rules for the purposes of transcripts so that we wouldn't have to send a letter to all the companies. They would just know in the rule that they can request the transcripts from hearings.
And pay for it themselves and send us copies. They pay, we get.
All of those things.
I take it we're at the end.
So that would be a rule that, because how do we do it now?
We send them a letter when there's a hearing.
It's in our rules right now, but we've just changed the rule. So
who all gets the letter?
Whoever's a party gets a letter that says we don't do a transcript, we do a recording. If you want a transcript, you hire them yourself, you pay for it yourself. But if you do get a real transcript, you send us the original and a copy. Okay. Something
so
like
the
that.
The rule would just make that a rule.
Yeah. It would just be in there and we wouldn't have to send a letter and John would be really happy.
Mm. So right now the rule says we'll send you a letter?
Doesn't say anything now. There is no rule on it now.
Oh, okay.
Well, there's something in the rules about the transcripts, but it says the ALJ shall transcript.
There might be something, but not this. There's nothing. The law says you get electronic.
Fix it.
And the day we're fixing this issue.
Yeah, we're fixing it. Yeah.
That's all I had to discuss.
I'm in favor of that.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I had to discuss. I'm sorry that it was a little haphazard. I was just trying to gather all these different comments from different people about possible rulemakings and at least see different discussion. If there's anything else you guys have as well, just feel free to shoot in my direction.
This is, I think, exactly how we envisioned this happening. Like every once in a while we'd sit down and talk about everything and get it on the next rule thing. So it's good.
Looks great. Thanks. Okay.
All right.
Anything else? All right. We are concluded.